According to the Hemp Industries Association, hemp use goes back more than 10,000 years. Appreciated for the quality of its fibers, it was cultivated in England as early as 800 BC. In the history of this country, it was farmed by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. But there's been no legal hemp production in the U.S. since the first half of the 20th century, mainly because of its association to weed. That's beginning to change, however, because hemp as a cash crop may be too valuable to ignore. Brian Grimmett from the Kansas News Service has looked into all of this. Here's part of his recent story.
If Kansas farmers want to know what they're getting themselves into, all they have to do is look to Colorado. 5 years ago, it became the first state in the country to let people start growing industrial hemp again.
See, we've got a clean room. We're actually making cannabinoids over there.
Ed Lehrberger is the CEO of Pure Hemp Technologies. His company has developed ways to process the plant into products people want to buy. The stalks of the plant can be used to make rope or insulation, while the plant's flower can be pressed into an oil rich with a chemical known as CBD. Products infused with CBD oils are marketed to treat a variety of ailments and drive the demand for hemp in the U.S. right now. In time, there's hope the fiber will sell too.
So this room gets completely filled with freshly cut hemp stalks.
He says in Colorado, farmers and processors had to learn how to make the industry work through trial and error, because you might be able to grow it, but that doesn't mean someone will buy it.
And that first and second year, there were no markets, and they didn't know what to do. And I mean, we'd get calls from farmers, God, we grew hemp, we heard you guys were processing it, and are you going to buy our hemp or not? Well, no, we're not. We bought in a lot, and we've got more than we can handle.
In those chaotic first few years, he says some farmers saw great success, while many others failed completely.
So Colorado and a handful of other states have begun to legalize the growing of industrial hemp, and earlier this year, Kansas became one of them. Here to talk about all of this is the aforementioned Brian Grimmett from the Kansas News Service. He joins us from KUER in Salt Lake City this morning. Brian, good morning.
Good morning.
In the studio with me, Chad Bontrager, director of the Kansas Department of Agriculture's Agribusiness Development Division, who is with me this morning. Chad, thank you.
Thank you.
Brian, I'm going to start with you. So what pitfalls do Kansas farmers have to look at if they're going to grow hemp?
One of the biggest pitfalls out there is really just kind of figuring out the chain of where does the product go. So you're going to grow it. Who's going to process it? Who do you sell it to? Getting over some of those legal hurdles as well, which Mr. Bontrager can talk about. But really that's it. Is once you've grown it. So where do you get your seed? Then you've grown it, and then what do you do with it once you've grown it?
Just how much money is out there, Brian, for farmers who want to take the plunge and start into the industrial hemp business?
It kind of depends on who you ask. I mean, the most optimistic predictions out there say, you know, across the country in the next 5 to 10 years, we're talking about a $1 billion industry. But really on the individual level, it just kind of depends. How many acres do you plant? It's just like kind of any regular farming with you know, corn or soybean. What is the price that you can get for it, and how many acres can you grow successfully?
Chad, hemp and marijuana from the same plant species. What makes hemp industrial by definition, and how does that fit into this new Kansas law?
So the key piece of measurement is the amount of THC in the industrial hemp product. And in order to be classified as an industrial hemp, it has to be 0.3% THC or less. And that's really the big driver of the difference between the two.
How do you measure that? I mean, it's not like a breathalyzer test or a blood. So how do you make sure that the THC level is conforms with Kansas law?
We've got a machine in our laboratory common to laboratories across the country that's called a high pressure gas chromatograph. And there's probably some other descriptors that go along with that that I'm not as familiar with. But basically, we load a sample, a leaf sample, stock sample, flower sample, whatever we've got into that machine, and it can take the measurement to determine the concentration.
Brian, this isn't the first time that hemp will have been grown in Kansas. It has a little bit of a history here. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, talking to some of the advocates here, hemp, I mean, it had a long history, especially kind of Civil War to pre-World War I. It was a crop that grew all over the place, including in Kansas. Kentucky was kind of one of the bigger growers, which is why I think they've jumped back on to the bandwagon, so to speak, of seeing this as a potential cash crop. But even here in Kansas, one of the tidbits of information that I got was that during the World during the Civil War era, there were Kansas was grew what was it? I think some the most per capita hemp. So I mean, it has a long past here.
So Chad, what do you use this stuff for?
Well, you know, there's a long list of things, and there was some allusion to this in the segment there at the beginning. But the fiber can go into construction products, you know, mix hemp fiber with concrete. You can make a rope type material out of it. I've heard of it being used potentially for car panels and that kind of thing. The seed, obviously, to grow more hemp is going to be a big use of seed, but you can also extract oil from the seed that can be used for food, things of that nature. And then you've got the flower, whose primary purpose is to go into the CBD oil.
So, Chad, I want to grow hemp in Kansas. What do I do?
Well, right now you wait until the end of the year. So when the legislature passed the statute in April and the governor signed it, we began work on putting together the regulations to make that all possible in Kansas. And the legislature gave us until the end of this calendar year to get that done. So we're actively working on that right now. But our intention will be that once the regulations are in place, you apply, you say what research you're going to do, you do a background check, you submit your fingerprints. That's reviewed by an advisory board that then makes a recommendation to the Secretary of Agriculture as to whether or not you should be approved.
That's Chad Bontrager, Director of the Kansas Department of Agriculture's Agribusiness Development Division. We're talking about hemp and growing it in Kansas here on Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Also with me this morning, Brian Grimmett from the Kansas News Service. Brian, talk to me a little bit about the other pitfalls of growing hemp. Can farmers, for example, get crop insurance from the USDA? A hailstorm can do a lot of damage in Kansas. Also, might farmers have some problems getting traditional bank loans for hemp production?
Yeah, that is also one of the bigger issues, is just the regulations around it. So even though these states have been given the permission to create these research pilot projects, it's still considered by the federal government a Schedule One drug, so like heroin or you know, cocaine, those kind of things. So the federal government still looks at this as a no-no. And so right now, at least, you can't get crop insurance, and there aren't even really companies out there creating chemicals to spray for weeds. Not weed as in marijuana, but actual weeds that can bother the crop as it grows. And so that becomes a big issue. If you can't keep the weeds under control in your field, it can have a pretty big impact on the yield that you're going to get from the hemp. Like you said, you also mentioned the bank loans. A lot of banks, because they're federally insured through the FDIC, they're weary of being involved in any kind of hemp or marijuana operations. And so trying to get a loan for that, there are ways to get the money to start up, and some banks are out there doing creative things, and a lot of it's just private investors. So those do become big hurdles, because, you know, trying to get the machines that can harvest it and can separate it and can process it, you know, that takes capital. And so trying to find investors who can pay for that becomes a big issue, especially when you're dealing mostly in cash.
Chad, I saw you nodding your head in agreement here. Talk to me a little bit about, from your perspective, about those problems. Crop insurance, financing, these are two big pillars of any agricultural production.
You know, one of the things that we've heard from some of the folks involved in that segment of the agriculture industry that have experience with agriculture lending and crop insurance and so forth is it's pretty unclear to them as to whether or not, if they put money into industrial hemp, does that violate the rules that control their particular piece of the industry. And so I think there's some hesitation there as it relates to that. And then I also think it's new and different. We're not nearly as experienced with it as we are with wheat and corn and soybeans in Kansas. And so just some concern about how do we move forward with that.
How, if at all, is Kansas recruiting hemp farmers, opening the door, trying to identify who might want to take the leap into this unknown crop?
The Department of Agriculture is not necessarily recruiting anyone to do that, but we know that in the private sector, there's a fair amount of that going on. We've heard from folks that are interested in doing processing, lots of Kansans that are interested in growing, being hemp farmers, and we're trying to get make sure that they have a connection to a processor or a distributor so that they don't grow it and then not have anything to do with the finished crop. But there's a lot of that going on in the private sector. The Department of Agriculture is not necessarily doing any active recruitment. What we're focused on right now is getting the regulations in place so folks can do this in the next growing season. And then maybe we can be more helpful on the other end as we get that complete.
Brian, I want to ask you in a moment about what other states are doing. But, Chad, I want to ask you, is there research going on now at Kansas State, at any other university in the state about best practices for hemp production, growing it, processing it? Is there any research going on now in Kansas?
I'm not aware of any active research projects. Certainly with this research pilot program that we're in the process of implementing, we hope to have several things along that line where the university is working directly with farmers and processors, just like they do on the other agricultural crops that we're growing in the state, so that we can have that data going forward. Extension can use that to communicate information to farmers that are interested and so forth. So we're hopeful to see that. I'm not aware of anything currently going on. I know we've had some interest in the universities are watching closely our development of the regulation piece so that they know how they can work in that space.
Brian, you took us to Colorado, so we heard a little bit about a hemp producer there. You talked a little bit about what's happening in Kentucky. In your reporting, did you turn up any other states that are leading the way in this, that are wanting to open the door to hemp production?
Yeah, those two states are definitely the leaders right now as far as acres approved and acres planted. Several other states have approved. I think there's up to about 40 states that have enacted some kind of hemp bill or are getting close to even being. I think it's 19 states that, at least according in 2017, that have these pilot projects. But a lot of those states are keeping it. Not all these pilot projects are the same. So in Colorado and Kentucky, for example, they've really opened it up to allow pretty much anyone to apply and to be able to start growing if they meet the requirements. And in other states, like in Nebraska, for example, they have a pilot program, but it's really limited. I mean, they had 1 acre planted in 2017, and then they keep it really strict to the universities. And so it really depends on how far the legislature or the state regulatory bodies are willing to go to kind of experiment with who do we want to grow this and how controlled do we want to have it.
Where's the United States Congress on this, Brian?
They're trying to figure it out themselves. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, he sees it as a big boost for his state. So he has proposed legislation that passed, at least in the Senate, that would open up industrial hemp federally. So to be able to grow it like basically kind of similar to the state pilot programs, but open it up federally across the country. It's kind of tagged to the farm bill, and that hasn't passed both houses yet. So it's kind of up in the air as whether or not that's going to be approved. But again, the Senate did approve his bill, and so it looks like it's heading towards, at least for industrial hemp, that it could soon be legalized, which would open up the doors to things like crop insurance and being able to get financing through banks. But again, it's still up in the air, at least at this moment.
Chad, we've heard a lot about tariffs and agricultural products being shipped overseas, and I'm wondering if there is a international market for hemp.
You know, I've been led to believe that there is. there's some pretty significant hoops on how you move a hemp product into those markets, you know, in terms of transportation logistics and staying compliant with federal law. The DEA does have a tool that allows for, you know, for example, we can import certified seed into Kansas through the same tool that you could use to export hemp products, is my understanding. So I believe there is a market there. It's primarily the CBD oil, maybe some fiber market, but it's definitely something that I think as we get further into this is going to be an area we need to look at.
Well, I tell you what, it sure feels like we're writing the rules as we're going here. Like we're sort of going back to the beginning of agriculture time, right? We've been growing soybeans and wheat in Kansas for centuries, and we know what to do with this. It feels to me like we're not quite sure what we're going to do, so we're writing history as we go.
Well, and we... It has been pretty challenging at the Department of Agriculture when we work on regulations. Typically, there's already something in place, and we're just modifying, striking things out, adding things in, whatever the case may be. There's something to work with. And in this particular case, there was not. So we really started from scratch. Now, we didn't reinvent the wheel if we didn't have to. So we looked at other states like Kentucky, Colorado, Wisconsin, several others, and tried to pull in the things that we thought were most applicable for us and then make it work in Kansas. But certainly has been, like you said, kind of going to the beginning and starting from scratch. And, you know, you start thinking about all the things we do when we're growing wheat or corn or soybeans or grain sorghum. There's not nearly as many rules. I mean, they're not special exemptions for those from the list of Schedule One narcotics. So you start thinking, well, here's the things that I do as a farmer when I'm growing those crops. And there's a whole lot of steps in the process that with industrial hemp and a research pilot program, we have to figure out the regulatory piece for, whereas in those other crops, there isn't a regulatory piece. So it's been a very unique challenge.
Brian, you talked a little bit about what's happening in Congress. So there is a lot of politics around this, certainly nationally, and then going back to getting the Kansas legislature to approve this. Talk to me a little bit about the politics behind all of this.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think because it does have, there's this long history, I think going back especially to the 60s and 70s of this fight against drugs, that hemp really got lumped into that as being this really dangerous, illicit substance, this thing. And so trying to fight that stigma has been really the challenge of people who are promoting industrial hemp, is saying, hey, this is different. This is a thing that we can think of just like we think of any other crop. Like we think of soybeans, like we think of corn. It is something we can grow. It doesn't have to be dangerous. It doesn't have to have those psychotropic parts to it, the THC. We can do this in a way that this can be treated like any other crop out there. And there is beginning, I think, to be, it started slowly. It's taken years, but more and more states are seeing the success that Colorado and Kentucky are having and saying, well, maybe we want a piece of that pie. Maybe we want to get some of the tax revenue that comes from growing this plant. And that's really what the challenge has been, is really just changing those minds from saying this isn't necessarily, while it's the same plant, it doesn't have to be considered the drug that marijuana is anymore.
I want to give one last quick word to you, Chad, and ask you if the state of Kansas is bullish on hemp.
I think we are. I mean, the history tells us that it can do really well here. It's been several decades since we've had any hemp in abundance, but we're looking forward to getting our piece of the puzzle done so folks can start growing that, and we'll see how it goes.
Chad Bontrager with the Kansas Department of Agriculture, thanks for joining me in the studio.
Thank you.
Brian Grimmett, taking a little time off from his vacation to tell us about hemp. Brian, thank you.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Still ahead, where you look at Truman's desegregation of the armed forces and what life in the Army was like for one woman of color. I'm Sam Zeff. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Welcome back to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Sam Zeff. Yesterday on the program, we asked the new superintendent of the Shawnee Mission School District about the Special Education Department, Student Freedom of Speech, and School Financing. Hear his answers at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, you're probably saying, Sam, what's on the show tomorrow? KCUR's indie foreign and documentary film critics return. They'll tell us about a teenage outcast turned hustler, a father-daughter duo living in the woods, and a telemarketer who discovers the key to success. Join us tomorrow on Up to Date. So it seems to me that outside of the actual formation of the United States Army, Navy, and Marine Corps, Executive Order 9981, signed by President Harry Truman on this date in 1948, might just be the second most important anniversary in American military history. Joining me, Ron James, is an attorney in Washington, D.C., and the author of Double V, How Wars, Protest, and Harry Truman Desegregated America's Military. Ron, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Retired Army Colonel Norma Bradford has been in the military in one way or another since she was in college in the 1980s. She was a black female officer, which is still not a particularly common thing in the service, Colonel. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to remind you that Mr. James and Colonel Bradford will be speaking at 6:30 today at the Harry S. Truman Library and Institute in Independence. More information at the TrumanLibraryInstitute.org. Ron, I want to start with you. And there's a photo in your book that I particularly liked. It's the one of your grandfather as a military policeman in World War II. Talk to me about that photo and what it means to you.
Well, I was very happy to be able to include that photo in the Double V. My grandfather did serve, and the book is dedicated to the memory of my grandfather, who served in World War II, in part so that his sons, he had three sons, all of whom were retired military officers, would serve in a better military and live in a fairer nation. And it meant a great deal for my family to have that photo included.
Was it inspiring as you wrote the book?
Absolutely. As I learned more of what my grandfather had gone through, he served in Alabama during World War II as a military police officer, and learned more about the things that he had gone through and the things that soldiers like him had gone through, and sailors and the sailors before them had gone through. It gave me a greater appreciation, even though I had heard stories from my uncles. And my grandfather did not talk about it much, but I had heard stories from my uncles and my father.
Colonel, I'm wondering if there is a African-American officer, even an enlisted person for that matter, who was a mentor, a hero, an inspiration to you?
Thank you for that question. Mostly my mentors were white males, but there are the first African-American officer in the military was Lieutenant Colonel Charity Early. She commanded a battalion, a postal battalion, of over 800 African-American women, and she was the first black female officer. So I stand on her shoulders.
Are there other, as you look back in history, African-American service members who you've modeled yourself after, who inspired you to move forward in your career?
Yes, as I went along in my career, General West, General Gwen Bingham, they were all inspiration to me, Major General Maria Anderson. So they were all African-American women who started out with different circumstances and rose in the rank in the military. So, yes.
I want to go back to you, just go back to your grandfather for a moment, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. Ron, and tell me what it was like for him in Alabama as an MP in World War II.
African-American soldiers stationed in the Deep South in World War II were it was a politically charged issue to place African-American soldiers in the South in World War II. And that was in part because of what had happened in World War I with African-American soldiers from the North being placed in the South in World War II. And there ended up being racial violence. The military police officers, it was a, when my grandfather became a military police officer, that was a step forward for the Department of the Army, allowing African-Americans to become military police officers so that those police officers would be in charge of the segregated African-American part of the base. So it actually was a step forward, kind of in the vein of on a different level, but kind of in the same vein as the Tuskegee Airmen, also in Alabama, serving as African-American air pilots. And we sometimes forget that the formation of the Tuskegee Airmen unit was controversial at the time. It's celebrated now for many proper reasons, but the creation of these African-American units to military police units to police the segregated parts of the base was seen as a step forward, was seen as a bit of progress in the Department of the Army at the time.
I want to talk a little bit more about the history of African Americans in the United States military. There's always been African Americans in the United States Yes. military going back to the Revolutionary War. But it always seems to have been a reluctant thing on the part of the government, that there was always something that prevented African Americans from joining the service. The Marine Corps didn't integrate for a long time, didn't accept Marines. In the Civil War, they were reluctant to put them into combat. That's true in World War One. Having said all of that, why didn't African Americans give up, right? There was, it seemed to be such a barrier, so hard for them to serve, to put themselves in harm's way. Why do you think that African Americans didn't give up on that?
I think it's because, as W.B. Du Bois put it best when he said, "We have no ordinary interest in the fight." And that goes back even before the Revolutionary War, when it was the English government who first tied fighting in battle to full rights of being a human being. And that was Lord Dunmore in Virginia. And he said, "Any Virginian slave who comes in fights with me will be free under the crown of England." And he was flooded with women and children coming to the ship where he told everyone to come to. But he was also greeted with scores and scores of men. And this was the first time it was a government official had connected serving in the war with gaining, with African-Americans gaining their full rights as men and women. And then it went beyond that. The Continental Army excluded African-Americans until it needed them a few years later. And then we move up to the Civil War, and Frederick Douglass was imploring the federal government, saying that the colored man has to be allowed to fight for his own freedom. So there's been this connection to the right to fight, so to speak, and the rights that we have under the Constitution of the United States.
Norm, I want to hear your thoughts on that. You're nodding your head vigorously over there. And I want to hear your thoughts on this. Why do you think that through history, African Americans just didn't give up on the military? You know what? They don't want us. The hell with them. But they never said that. And I want to hear your thoughts on that.
That's just who we are as African Americans. Maya Angelou has a poem called "Our Grandmothers." And in one of her lines, she says, "I come as one, but I stand as 10,000. So we only didn't continue for ourselves. We continued for other blacks to have the same rights as everyone else. All we wanted to do was to serve our country and do our job. So if we gave up, then what were we really fighting for? Yeah. So yeah. I agree a lot with what Ron said. So, yeah.
So even though the United States was late to desegregating the military in 1948 by Harry Truman, it seems to me that generally the military leaned into that. I mean, this was before Brown versus Board of Education, certainly before lunch counter sit-ins in the South. So I'm wondering, Norma, if it feels to you as if once it happened, the military really embraced it, or was there a knockdown, drag out fight so somebody's like yourself could end up being a colonel?
Yeah, I don't think it was embraced right away, and the execution didn't happen immediately, but the Army in particular, because that's what I'm in. That was an organization that is kind of a leader in diversity and giving other opportunities, not only to black soldiers, but female soldiers. So I think that even though it didn't happen as fast as we wanted it to happen, they have made great strides over the years in integrating not only just black soldiers, female soldiers as well.
And African-American female officers in particular, there was always seems to be a reluctance. We'll let you come in as an enlisted person, yeah. but an officer,
yeah.
That was very difficult. Yes. Was that a harder, you think that was a harder barrier to overcome? And how do you think that played, if at all, into your career?
Yes, I think it was because women being in charge in this male-dominated military, I think that was a point of discussion. And then having an African-American as a leader, it just was not looked well upon. When I became an officer, I went to a small historically black college in Mississippi, and there were 17 of us, and I was the only female in my class, but everybody looked like me. And so it was a continual pursuit of being a part of the organization. And yeah, it's just continuous. We still don't have a lot of African-American females, and it's just something we're still working on.
In the ranks or in the officer corps?
In the officer corps. And especially in the senior officer corps. I don't know the percentage at this time, but there's not a lot of female, African-American female colonels at this time.
Right. So when you say senior officer corps, you're talking about above the rank of major.
Yes.
So colonel, lieutenant colonel,
colonel,
and into general officers.
Yes.
This is, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. With me today, retired Army Colonel Norma Bradford and Ron James, an attorney in Washington and author of Double V, How Ward's Protest and Harry Truman Desegregated the America Military. And you'll be able to hear both of them tonight at the Truman Library in Independence as we celebrate. And I think we can certainly say we can celebrate the desegregation of the United States military by Harry Truman in 1948. Ron, I want to get back to you and talk a little bit about how African-Americans didn't always take it. And I'm specifically thinking about what the Army referred to as a mutiny in Houston during World War I, when there was an armed confrontation between members of a all-black company and Houston authorities. Talk to me about that incident.
Yeah, and Houston, that's the Houston Mutiny. And so this is during World War I. And before this, the Southern, including Texas, the Southern Congress, congressional representatives and senators had told the War Department, do not send colored soldiers from northern states, and particularly do not send officers down to the southern states. We will have a problem. They're not used to the way we do things down here. The officers' candidate school had just opened for African Americans in Fort Des Moines. So the
In and of itself was kind of a huge political deal, was it not?
Yes, that was a big deal, a major victory. And what that did was it took away many of the senior non-commissioned officers who were African Americans, so that the junior officers and the younger men were left for basic training in the southern states and in Houston. And the some of the individuals, particularly from New York State, they actually refused to sit in the back of the bus when they left the base. And so they were victims of police brutality. On one particular day, a soldier was out in the town. He saw a police officer beating an African-American woman using language you cannot use on the radio. And the soldier intervened and said, whatever fine she has to pay, please let me pay it. And that police officer and another police officer then grabbed that soldier and beat him vigorously, took him to the police station. By the time the word got back to the base, the word was that the soldier had been killed by the police officers. So the African-American soldier said, "This is enough. We've had it." And it became what so many of the Southern white politicians had predicted, was that these black men then used their military training to take up arms against the white power structure out in Houston, off the base. And in the end, I believe it was 11 white civilians were killed. They killed a man in his car. They killed someone's dog. It was a very ugly scene. They were shot. It was a race war. It's not just one-sided. The civilians were shooting back. The police were shooting back. It was a terrible, bloody scene. It became a story that was used by both progressives and the Southern segregationists going forward about the dangers associated with training African-American soldiers in the Deep South. The fact of the matter is the War Department, now the Department of the Army, had to ignore that because that's where the good weather was when we needed to train individuals, in the winter months.
If I'm not mistaken, there's a Kansas connection to this. Is there not? This is where it was the disciplinary barracks at Leavenworth where some of these soldiers did their time and may have been hanged. Am I right?
Yes, yes. And they were hanged there at Fort Leavenworth. Yes.
Right. I want to go back, Norma, to something you said before about lack of African-American women in the senior officer corps and ask you what can the military do? What should they do to remedy that?
Great question.
That's why I make the big money. That's why they let me sit over here.
I think, what can they do? I mean, we're there. Maybe some of the enlisted soldiers can apply for the officer candidate school. That's another avenue where you can come in and to be an officer and progress up the promotion ladder. Maybe look at how they do the promotions. Usually the majority are white males in the promotion system. So maybe look at how they do the promotions. I don't know.
Difficult. It is a difficult problem, is it?
Yeah, it's a difficult problem, and it's something that because we're great leaders, we are a great asset to have in any organization. So yeah, that is something that I personally need to do more research on to see that how can we improve the numbers. It has improved, but it always can be better.
As you were coming out of college with a career in the United States Army on your mind, did you think that this was going to be a career that you were going to come out as a full colonel, or did it surprise you a little bit as you were moving up through the ranks?
Oh my God, it surprised me. I didn't even expect the military to be my career. I got into ROTC in college because they was giving out $100 a month as an incentive to be in the program. So for me, I'm a little girl from Mississippi, and that was a lot of money to me. So I didn't expect to stay in the military. When I got out, I was commissioned as a Army Reserve officer. So the first year and a half, I only did 1 weekend a month in 2 weeks out of the year. And after that, I went back to my little hometown where I was working in a factory that my mom worked in. And I had this commission, so I said, why not use it? And so certainly I didn't expect to stay in 20 years. I didn't expect to stay in 1 year. But after their promotions and being a part of a team that was way bigger than anything that I've ever could imagine. I stayed in. I had a daughter. It allowed me to take care of her and just be a positive influence for other young black females in particular and women in general. I remember this incident. I was in Virginia and I was sitting in the cafeteria, and after I had made Fulbert Colonel, someone came over and touched me on the shoulder, and it was a young specialist. And she asked me, could she touch me, because she had never seen a female African-American Fulbright Colonel. And it made me sad. I was proud, but it also made me sad. And I actually went in the car and I cried a little bit because it was like a light bulb moment that I am really having an impact on other females, and in particular African-American females. So I just always wanted to be a good role model.
I have to say that I'm not sure why that surprises me that you were so emotional. So I just want to explore that just for a moment. Was it an impact that you're having on young African-Americans in the United States Army, but was it a time to reflect back on your own life, your own service? Talk to me a little bit more about that. I'm intrigued.
Yes, I'm from a small rural town. It's called Casilla, Mississippi. Population probably 500 now. When I was growing up, it was probably much less. And so a little black girl from a little small town in Mississippi, rising through the ranks and making Fulbright Colonel in the United States Army, I don't take it for granted. It don't happen every day. I had a great support system from my parents. Nobody in my family, immediate family, was in the military. I had an uncle who did Vietnam from 65 to 68, I think, but we never knew about it, and he didn't talk much about it. So I do get emotional when I talk about that because of the shoulders of the people that I stand on and all the things that they went through for me to have the opportunity to serve in the military. Yeah, it's a pretty emotional time, and I don't even really like to talk about some of the bad stuff because there's a gospel song that says my good days outweigh my bad days. So my days in the military, the good days really outweighed the bad days, and it was a great experience, and I would do it all over again. So, yeah, I did get a little emotional about that.
I would be remiss if we didn't take a couple of minutes to talk about Harry Truman. He is a political hero of mine. A lot of people in Missouri might claim that. But I want to talk to you, Ron, a little bit about what may have been an unexpected president to desegregate the military. Grows up in a segregated state. Very early on in his life, he's a member of the KKK. He quickly disavows that and certainly becomes pretty progressive through his presidency. So talk to me a little bit about Harry Truman and what went into signing that now famous executive order.
Certainly. First, it's good to note that the executive order, which was issued 70 years ago today, no one knew what it meant when it was issued. And so they asked the press asked Colonel Omar Bradley, said, okay, well, do you plan to desegregate the Army now? General Omar Bradley, do you plan to desegregate the Army? And he says, no, not at all. That's not what this says. And African-American leaders said, what does this say? So finally, President Truman had to issue a clarification and say, yes, this means desegregation of the armed forces.
Because you'd want that to be as muddy as possible.
Okay. Right, exactly. So this man who was known for speaking so clearly, but the document speaks, really it speaks to time because it speaks, says that, that all positions shall be open to all, opportunity open to all. So the document speaks to time, but at the moment, though, it did not provide the clarity that people were looking for. But President Truman had politically always been astute to the concerns of African Americans because he needed their support. Even from the time when he was the chief judge, the Pendergrass machine was that had put him in office was astute to the concerns of African Americans, and they were. They tried to address them. So even from the time when he was a local official here in Missouri, he, as a political matter, tried to understand the concerns of his African-American constituents. He consistently voted for the anti-lynching legislation when he was a senator. And he depended greatly. Without African-American voters, he would not have been reelected to the Senate. And so with some of his early personal rhetoric, it would be surprising, but President Truman, even as a senator and even as a judge, had always been politically concerned with the struggles of African Americans.
Norma, I want to ask you what this means to you. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I want to hear your thoughts about Harry Truman desegregating the military and what that makes you think about.
I wasn't aware of all the things that President Truman had done. It wasn't at the forefront of my thoughts when I was a commission as an officer in the United States Army. But if it wasn't for his desegregation, then I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you about rising to the rank of colonel in the United States Army. So it means a whole lot. I think Colin Powell says he owed his career to President Truman or something to that effect. So it's been very had a great influence on my career, even if I didn't even know what he had done for us.
Ron, I want to give you, you get the final word today. If there's something that we need to take away from this executive order, from this important anniversary, what is it?
This executive order helped create the military that we have today. And our military is the best example of America. In my day job, I'm a civilian. I work at the Pentagon. I encourage people, if you happen to visit Washington, D.C., visit the Pentagon. Walk through the halls. You will see all kinds of Americans there working to defend our country.
I agree.
Ron James, author of Double V, How Wars, Protest, and Harry Truman Desegregated the American Military. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Colonel Norma Bradford, U.S. Army retired. Thank you. I hope everybody
Thank
will go out and see
me.
Them tonight at the Truman Library in Independence. KCUR, you can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. I'm Sam Zeff. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Tomorrow, the competitive world of eSports on one local university, new varsity gaming team. Program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Sam Zeff, and you are up to date.